Okay, good morning, ladies and gentlemen.
Good morning.
Nice to see you all here. Everyone here in person and everyone here virtually on the Zoom. Just like to make a dedication here. The Shiurim has been sponsored by Ilu Nishmas, Miriam Bas Avraham and Shem Tov Ben Shlomo, and also Henry and Wendy Breacher of London, Chaim Yitzchak Elia Ben Zaev and Sarah Pesa Leah Bas Yitzchak, Hei Zichron Baruch. We are looking at the Maharal, and this takes us back approximately 500 years into the center of Europe, into the kingdom of what at that time was Bohemia, and Prague was a central city, both from a Jewish point of view and a commercial and intellectual point of view in Europe. And the Jews loved Prague. They kept on coming back. They were thrown out repeatedly out of Prague. Again and again, any event that took place, there were some famous events where some demented member of the Jewish community killed a Jewish child. He was, of course, burnt at the stake, and this created a pogrom, and they were all expelled from Prague. But it's interesting, for example, in 1389, there was a great pogrom of this sort, and all the Jews were expelled. But in 1493, they were all asked to come back again because the economy dried up. The whole economic system of Prague dried up because the Jews were borrowing and lending money. The Jews had their own banking system. They had letters of credit. There was no official banks at the time. When you wanted to buy a field, to buy a building, you couldn't come with a truckload of silver. You had to have letters of credit. You had to have some form of banking, which only the Jews were running. And therefore, when the Jews were thrown out, the whole economy ceased, right? So the king begged them to come back again, and then they got back into the only profession they were allowed to practice, which was money lending. They weren't allowed to do anything else. Money lending from the documents that we have was sort of you borrowed money from the nobleman at about 25%, and then you lent it out to other people at 40%, and that was your business, right? The problem was twofold. First of all, you weren't very popular if you were lending money at 40%, right? It wasn't a segula for arichus yomim. You know, you became the enemy of lots of people if you were lending money at 40%. In addition to which, some of the debts proved to be uncollectible. So it was a hazardous business, but it was the only business that they could do. But the Jews understood the business of commerce, of lending and borrowing money, and kept the whole economy going. Was also part of the genius of the Jewish community in Europe was also the fact that they had the very best what we call today networking. Right, networking is a wonderful word. I love the word networking. Networking means that people knew each other and trusted each other and were in contact with each other. And therefore, if somebody wanted to buy a shipload of goods that was coming into Venice, right, they needed money in Venice to buy it, but they were living in Prague. So they could only go to a Jewish family who had a cousin in Venice. They would pay the money in Prague, and he would write them a note, usually in Yiddish or something like that, or in Hebrew, and that note was then presentable in Venice, and they would get the money from the cousin there. It was a primitive form of banking. That's how the Rothschilds became wealthy, because the Rothschild had five sons, and one was in London, one was in Paris, one was in Lisbon, one was in Frankfurt, and they had a banking system which worked on the basis of letters of credit, and therefore you didn't have to walk around with truckloads of gold and silver, right? There was no printed money yet. So in actual fact, the Jewish people were running, for all intents and purposes, they were running the economy, borrowing and lending money. And whenever they were thrown out, the economy dried up, and then the next king or prince who came into Maharal begged them to come back again, and they came back again, and they came back and forth. They were thrown out, and they came back a few years later. There's even one very humorous document where when they came back from being thrown out, they struck a deal with the king that that his government would protect the shul, the cemetery, the matzah baking factory, and the mikveh, right? These were the things mentioned. In the event that they're thrown out again, that the government would protect them so that when they came back again, which they inevitably would, right, it would still be intact. In other words, they knew this was almost part of life. You know, being expelled and coming back again became part of the almost natural, even though it was immensely tragic, back and forth of Jewish life, unimaginable to us really, but there were constantly recurring blood libels and persecutions and pogroms every Easter. Every Easter, we're coming up now actually, to, I just want to mention it just by the way, and that is, you know, nowadays Easter is like one of these Christian festivals, but for many, many centuries in Europe, Easter was the most dangerous time of the year. And very often we find in the shutim, in the shilas and chubas of many centuries, the Jews didn't go to shul on Pesach, and they didn't gather together on Pesach, and basically Pesach time, which was always Easter time, they hid. They hid because on Easter what would happen would be the priest would get up. What was Easter? Easter was the anniversary of the death of Jesus, right? So, and the priest inevitably would say that the Jews who were the devil were responsible for his death, and he would get them all motivated in hatred of the Jewish community, and they'd go out killing Jews at random and smashing Jewish properties. So Pesach, Easter was always a dangerous time of year. In addition to which, I just want to mention to you, if you go to the Altnoy Shul, some of you might have been to the Altnoy Shul in Prague. The Altnoy Shul, incidentally, is probably, we don't know exactly, but probably the longest functioning shul in the world. Because we know of that shul already from the 11th century. Don't forget, the Maral is coming in the 16th century. But the Altnoy Shul wasn't the shul that he built. Was a shul that's associated with the Maral because he was one of the most famous rabbonim there, but actually it predates him by many centuries. But one of the interesting things, if you go next time to the Altnoy Shul, that on the bima there, next to the bima, there's a little flag. Now, Jews generally didn't have flags, but this flag has got on it a flag with a yellow hat. And the yellow hat was a hat that they were forced to wear. Every Jewish man was forced to wear a yellow hat that came to a certain peak at the top. And it was humiliating to wear that, but it made them instantly identifiable in the street. So if there was an angry mob out and there was a Jew who was immediately identifiable, his life was gone. So it spelled danger, but he was forced to wear it, and it was part of the persecution that they had to wear it. In some of the, if you have Haggadahs, which have pictures from the Middle Ages, you will see Jews wearing these peak hats, and that was part of the persecution of places like Prague. It wasn't unique to Prague, but from Prague we still have things like the flag. I also mentioned to you, incidentally, that the Mogen David that we recognize as a Jewish symbol is also one of the earliest signs of the Mogen David. It is from Prague. Why exactly the Mogen David is associated with Judaism and the Jewish people is some bit of a mystery, actually. It has no sources in classic Jewish sources. We don't really know exactly where it came from. The six-pointed star is is connected to David HaMelech. In the Kabbalistic literature, there is reference to it. But when it started and how it started is not entirely clear. One of the reasons it's connected to David, incidentally, if you're interested, what do you say?
It's the Dalet.
The Dalet, yes, thank you. In the ancient Jewish script, a dalet was a triangle, right? So the double triangle is the dalet. The name David is written dalet ver dalet. Dalet vov dalet is the two triangles superimposed one on top of the other. That's David. So the name, you understand what I mean? There are two letters here, two triangles or two dalets. And that is the name David. So exactly who invented that And when it came to be a flag or a symbol or icon of some sort, subject for a doctorate for you. You can write, do a research. Somebody can do some sort of, I don't know. I haven't seen anything more intelligible than what I've just told you about how that came to be. One of the things is for sure that in Prague is one of the earliest times that the Jews had that emblem and that flag, and it was a symbol of the Jewish community, a sort of, I think, a yellow mug and dovid against a red background became a sort of a symbol. Anyhow, Kolponim, Prague was a center of Jewish life for many centuries in the Middle Ages. I'm only mentioning this because this is where the Maharal came to. Maharal is entering into Prague, and commercial life is booming, right? And the Jews are at the center of commercial life, but at the same time, Jewish life is booming. Jewish life is booming. There's Torah being learnt and being taught. There are yeshivas, there are shuls, there are mikvahs, there is matzah baking. There is the full spectrum of Jewish life going on in Prague at that time. And when the Maharal came in, he gave it additional depth and understanding. And in particular, what the Maharal is doing, and I'd like to bring for you today, you can see on the first sheet here, I brought you this timeline, which I brought you last week as well. The first sheet is the timeline, but I've highlighted in his major writings, can you see, I've highlighted number 4, which is a book he wrote called Gevurot Hashem. Can you see that? There's a list of 10 writings of his. He wrote more than that, but these are his 10 major works. And number 4 is Gevurot Hashem, which is an entire sefer dedicated only to Pesach and the Haggadah and all the issues connected to Yitziat Mitzrayim, right? Probably one of, to this day, 500 years later, probably one of the most spiritual, philosophically sophisticated books written about this subject, right? There's no end, right? You can go to a bookshop today, and there are 500 different Haggadahs to buy with different commentaries of one sort or another. But those which are more conceptual and spiritual will be citing the Maharal and Gevurot Hashem probably more than anybody else. The Maharal, of course, is using the full range of Zohar-type Kabbalistic material, but he's developing it in his own original way, and he's writing about it at length, Gesundheit, at length, and that is a something we're going to be looking at. Baruch atah Adonai Melech Haolam, Shachon Di Abvar. Excuse me 1 second. Right. Just got to make sure my pango is working, you know what I mean? Otherwise I'm really in trouble. You know, we'll have to make, these are such are the concerns of modern life, pango. Okay. Okay, turn to page 2 for a minute, and I want to just give you a little bit of a brief introduction. On page 2, I've brought you, at the top of the page, the first paragraph out of Seder Night, which is familiar to all of you. Ho lach mo'anyo di'acholu avos hono ba'ara de'mitzrayim. This is how we start Leil Seder. This is how we start this after we've made Kiddush, right? Kaddish Urchatz, Karpas Yachatz, we've done all that. We've made Kiddush, had the Karpas, broken the matzah in half, and now it's time to do what is really the core activity of Seder Night, which is what? Tell the story of Yetziat Mitzrayim. That's the word Magid. Magid, the word Haggadah, in fact, comes from the word Magid. To tell, that's the mitzvah, to tell the story, and that is the mitzvah Min HaTorah. There are 2 mitzvot min haTorah on Seder night, 2 biblical mitzvot. One is telling the story and the other is eating the matzah. And then there is a whole range of rabbinic mitzvahs like the 4 cups of wine and leaning a little bit. All the other issues on Seder night are of rabbinic origin, but min haTorah is telling the story and eating the matzah. So the first thing we do before we start telling the story is we introduce ourselves or reintroduce ourselves and everybody present to the matzah itself. And that's what we're going to be looking at. What is this core symbol of Pesach? What is special about this matzah? Why is the matzah at the heart of of the Pesach Yontov. So much so, incidentally, that in the Chumash itself, in the Torah, Pesach is never, the Yontov of Pesach is never called Pesach. It's called Chag HaMatzot. It's the festival of matzahs. That's the name of the Yontov. Why is that? Because the word Pesach in the Chumash means what? It means the sacrifice. It means the Korban Pesach. Whenever it says you should make the Pesach, it means make the Korban Pesach. It doesn't mean, when we speak about making Pesach, we think about cleaning the house out of chametz and making Seder night. In the time of the Chumash and the Tanakh, making Pesach means the sacrifice, the Paschal lamb that was sacrificed on Erev Pesach and eaten at the Seder night. That was the Pesach, right? In fact, in the Pasuk it says, Ba'arbo'oso yom lachodesh Pesach l'Hashem. That Pesach is on the 14th, not on the 15th. The 15th of Nisan is our Yontov starts. So why does the Torah say Pesach l'Hashem on the 14th? Because on the 14th, Korban Pesach, the sacrifice, was brought, right? On the 15th started something else. What was starting on the 15th? Chag HaMatzot. Are you following me? So there's a difference between Pesach. For us, Pesach and Chag HaMatzos are synonymous. They mean the same thing, right? But in the Chumash, in the text of the Chumash, Pesach and Matzos are actually two separate items, completely separate items. And the Yontov is Chag HaMatzot, so the matzah is the central symbol. What's so special about the matzah? The matzah is made of water and flour. It's the simplest of the simple, basic types of food. Baked in a panic. If you've ever been in a hand-bake matzah factory, the time, you know, everything is rushed, everybody's rushing everybody else, and there's a clock ticking, and then at a certain point there's a buzzer, and that's it. And then you've got to clean everything off, and wash it, wipe it all down, and change the thing, and then you start again, mixing the flour and the water, and then the clock starts ticking, and at a certain point, beep, and that's it. It's finished. In other words, everything is done under great speed. It's baked and kneaded under great speed, and the result is the matzah as we know it. But what happens is, at the beginning of the Seder, let's just read these words for a few minutes, at the top of page 2. Ha lach mo anya. I brought you the English translation here. This is the bread of aniya. Aniya means aniyut in Ivrit. Aniyut means poverty. Poverty, like, there's a translation here. An ani, ayin nun yud, is a poor man. So this is the bread of poverty. Diacholu avoshono ba'arad mitzrayim, that our ancestors ate in the land of Egypt. And that is the opening line of Leil Seder. And what does it mean? And this is maybe an opportunity to speak a little bit at Seder night about the matzah. The matzah is the central symbol, really, of Leil Seder. And we come back to the matzah later on, towards the end of Magid, in a piece of the Haggadah, which starts with the words, Rabbi Gamliel Hoya Omer, right? Which is, in fact, a Mishnah. In the 10th chapter of Psachim, the Mishnah says, Rabbi Gamliel Hoya Omer, Kol Shelo Omer Shlosha Dvorim BePesach Lo Yotzi DeChavosa Pesach Matzah Omaro, that this is part and parcel to understand the matzah, and to speak about the matzah is part and parcel of what it means to have a Leil Seder Haggadah, a mitzvah. So what is this? So there are two things that are said here about the matzah. The first is that it's lechem oni, lechem aniyut, the bread of poverty. But what does that mean exactly? It's the bread of poverty. What does that mean? So it's often, I'm going this morning to go along the route of the Maharal. We're learning today some Maharal. The Maharal is going to tell you that this is often misunderstood to mean that the Jewish people living in Mitzrayim were enslaved, right? And they were deprived of their wealth and belongings, and they were persecuted, and they were impoverished, and they were eating matzah while they were enslaved and impoverished, and we are eating matzah to commemorate that suffering of theirs. Says the Maharal, we don't find anywhere in the Tanakh or in the Gemara or in the Mishnah that the Jews as slaves were eating matzah. They weren't eating matzah. They were eating zochanos adoga. There are several references to the type of food they were eating in Mitzrayim, but matzah is never mentioned. So matzah wasn't the food of the poor slaves when they were enslaved. So what does it mean, this first line, ho lachmo anyo, this is the bread of poverty that our forefathers ate in the land of Egypt. When were they eating matzah? And the answer is, for the Maharal, they were eating matzah on the first Leil Seder. The moment of the redemption itself was on the 15th of Nisan. That was the time when they were instructed. In Shemos chapter 12, they're instructed on that night, Ba'erev Tochlu Matzot. On that night, the night that you're going to be redeemed from Egypt, you are going to eat matzahs. And don't forget, the redemption, why is the redemption from Egypt such a central point in the Torah and in Jewish thought? Because the redemption from Egypt was actually the creation of the Jewish people. That's when the Jewish people were created. It's the moment when the Jewish people came into existence as a nation. And that's a vital point to bear in mind throughout the Leil Seder. This is, in a sense, the like nations celebrate Independence Day, you know, the day that they create, the day the state was created is an important day to remember, because the day the state was created, you think back about why was it created, who created it, under what conditions was it, what was the purpose of creating this state, right? So the Jewish people didn't create a state, but they created Am Yisrael. Before that, they were B'nai Yaakov. They were the children of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. They were B'nai Yisrael before that. And now they became what is going to be called later on Mamlechet Kohanim V'Goy Kadosh. They're going to be transformed from a family into Am Yisrael, into a nation. And this is all taking place on that night. That was the moment of transition, Me'avdut l'chayrut, from slavery to freedom and into existence as Am Yisrael. So the Maharal is going to tell you that this matzah symbolizes that moment, symbolizes the moment of redemption. So actually, when it says lachmo anyo, the bread of poverty, right? It's talking about what could it possibly be talking about? Why poverty? That's what he wants to know. Why is poverty an important word here? Now, you might have thought, well, who wrote this text anyway? Why is it called poverty? And the answer is that in the book of Devarim, in the Chumash, it speaks about Pesach. And there it says, Shivas yomim tochlu matzot, you should eat matzahs for 7 days. Lechem oni, the Pasuk tells us in Parshas Re'eh, that for only once, in Shemos, when it's speaking about matzahs, just calls it matzahs. But suddenly, in Sefer Devarim, Moshe Rabbeinu says, you know what this is? 7 days you should eat matzahs. And what are they? They are lechem oni, the bread of poverty. Right? And then the pasuk goes on, why should you eat lechem oni? Ki b'chipazon yatzatim mimitzrayim. To commemorate that moment of redemption. But what's interesting is, why would the Torah call it poverty? Why is poverty here an interesting quality, an interesting feature of the matzah? And if indeed it wasn't eaten by the Jewish people in their suffering and in their poverty, why is it poverty? So let's have a look at this for a minute. So you can see halfway down the page, I've written Maharal Gevurot Hashem, chapter 51. Anybody who's feeling particularly brave can try and get hold of a Maharal chapter 51 and might make your way through it. It's not easy reading, and you need a lot of patience and a lot of time. And unfortunately, as far as I know, there is no English translation of Gevurot Hashem, as far as I know. But although some of the Haggadahs you've got, there is, I think, a Maharal Haggadah in English, if I'm not mistaken, which does have little extracts, and maybe it has this as well, I haven't checked. Anyhow, let's have a look underneath that line, Maharal Gevurot Hashem, chapter 51, Ma'amazeh Sidru Chachamim. This statement, what statement is he referring to? The one at the top of the page, Ho Lachmo Anyo, right? This was innovated by the Chachamim, Sheyoma, that you should say it, kedei lefarsem inyan halechem hazeh. We want to lefarsem. What does lefarsem mean? To publicize maybe here means to emphasize the nature, the inyan halechem hazeh, the nature of this bread that we're going to be eating on Leil Seder. For shehu lechem only she'achlo v'seinu b'mitzrayim, and that this was eaten in Egypt. Shemipnei she'kovu l'sadeh hagelda hazeh al halechem. And part of Seder night is to say the Haggadah al halechem. Interesting, this word. And that's why we have the matzah open in front of us, right, at the Seder table. And we especially open the matzah. It's there right in front of us. Why we open the matzah? Usually, before you eat the bread on a Friday night, it's covered, right? The bread is covered until you eat it, right? Here, we're not eating it yet, and nevertheless, it's lying there open. Why? So he says here, because Haggadah, the story of the Yetziat Mitzrayim, has to be said al halechem, with the presence of the bread in front of you, k'mo shedarshu, because Chazal in Gemara and Psachim, we're going to see in a minute, they derive from the posuk lechem oni, and you get here the reference in brackets, Devarim chapter Tetzayin 16, posuk 3. That's the one and only reference in the Torah to matzah being lechem oni. She Chazal darshan she onim olav Devarim. Now here's an interesting, and there it gives you in brackets the reference to that as well, the Gemara Psachim Kuf Tesvav, 115b. That is, the Chazal, and this is a classic case of drush, that the word oni, ayin, nun, yud, means also poverty, but that same word in Lashon HaKodesh also means what? Onim olav dvarim, la'anot means to respond, to answer, yes, it means to respond. I ask you a question, ata oneli, ani shoel ata one, right? It means to answer a question. And because of this word, oni, that Chazal understood to mean both poverty and answering, because of that, the whole nature of the Haggadah is questions and answers. Ma nishtana halayla hazeh, we get somebody to ask the questions, and then we give an answer, avodim hayinu. Why are we so interested in questions? Why don't we just tell the story? Why questions and answers? Why is that an integral part of the evening? And the answer is because of this one word, lechem oni, that it has to be the matzah is a bread over which people ask questions and we give them answers. In a sense, what it means is, if you understand the matzah properly, the matzah contains within it all the answers to the questions you're going to ask. Right, so the matzah has got a little sort of electronic chip in it, with all the answers. Right, it's got a memory stick inside the matzah, and if you know how to read it, it's got all the answers in the matzah. Right, it's built in. It's lechem oni, lechem shemaonim olav dvarim lefikoch matchil belechem. And that's why you start the Seder night not talking about the cups of wine, not talking about the how bad the Egyptians were, not talking about the suffering. We start off by saying this: the ikkar of the Seder night is to understand the role p'hol lachmo anya. This is what it's all about. And now we'll tell the story of Adim Hayinu Lefaro. But let's tell you first what the central theme is. So that's what he says here, Lefikach matchil b'lechem v'korek kruv alechem. He draws everybody's attention to the matzah, when he calls the lechem, to the matzah itself. And then he says in the second paragraph, which begins with the word v'heim dvorim, so he says, v'heim dvorim sheyachish akosav o'emes. I've edited out, of course. You should know the text I give you here in these shiurim is highly edited by me. Otherwise, I come here with 20 pages of text. I'm just bringing you highlights. So he says, some people think that lechem oni means it was bread that was eaten while they were enslaved. And then he says here in the second paragraph, v'heim dvorim sheyakrish akosav o'emes. That idea is denied in the Torah. Kilo nimso b'shum mako. We haven't found anywhere, he says, lo b'kosav, lo b'mishnah, lo b'talmud. In none of our sources do we find that what? Sha'amitzriim hoyim achirim es Yisrael matzah. That the Egyptians fed matzah to the Jewish people. We don't find any reference to that at all. It didn't have a hechsher. This is it, you see. The matzah was not baked with the proper hechsherim. You're probably right. Although that's probably in the realm of Purim Torah, but it's still Adar today, so we forgive you that this is maybe a Purim Torah. It could be, who knows. But they certainly, Omnoms, I'm in the third paragraph here, which I've brought in heavy type. Omnom, however, pirush hadava, what does it mean, oni, poverty? Ki hamatza nikrolechem oni, because the matzah, the object, the food matzah is a poor food. Not that the people were poor. It's not the people who were eating it were poor. It's the matzah itself is poor. In what sense will we call the matzah poor? He says, hefech matzah ashira. It's the opposite of matzah ashira. Now, matzah ashira is something you can buy in the shop. Matzah ashira is a well-known commodity. What does matzah ashira mean? Anybody know? Egg, what we call egg matzahs. Yes, thank you. It's sometimes marketed under the name egg matzahs. Or chocolate matzahs. You see, I see she's already got her whole shopping list for Pesach. To matzah ashira means what? That it was baked, enriched. That word ashira means, rich. Oshir is a rich person. Matzah ashira is enriched. What is it usually enriched with? That in the dough, when they're baking it, they don't just do water and flour. They put in either apple juice or oil or sugar or honey, or they put some enriched taste into the dough, right? Incidentally, you had a shir on that about there is an interesting debate in halacha. Do we or do we not eat matzah ashira on Pesach? Now, the truth is one can bake with additives in the dough, and it's still kosher LePesach because it doesn't rise. If it's done quickly and it doesn't become chametz, it doesn't rise, and therefore it's kosher LePesach. Everybody agrees, though, it's very important to point out, that on the Seder night itself, you can't use matzah ashira for the mitzvah of eating matzah. Why? Because of this pasuk. Because the pasuk says on Seder night you have to eat lechem oni. You have to eat it in its poor state. Probably the best translation here of poor means in its simple state, in its pure, only in the sense of pure, without additives, without enrichments. That's the point. Yes?
I thought that the Ashkenazim did the whole.
You're quite right. So Itamar's absolutely right. The Ashkenazim, right? Most of us are Ashkenazim. The Ashkenazim ruling following the Ramah, Rav Moshe Isserles, who was a contemporary, incidentally, of the Vilna, of the Maharal of Prague. The same years the Maharal was in Prague, the Ramah was in Krakow, right? That was the same period of time. Krakow was another major Jewish center in the 16th century. But the Ramah said, adding things other than water and flour into the dough is always tricky. Because we only know how long it takes for the dough to become chometz with water and flour. If you add fruit juice or honey, whatever, who knows? There might be certain enzymes in the additives that speed up the process of chametz, and therefore he was being machmir. But he said it's a chumrah. Chumrah meaning, strictly speaking, halachically, matzah ashira is kosher lePesach. The minhag of Ashkenaz is not to eat it. Although he does bring down that there could be people who are very elderly or sick for whom the regular matzahs doesn't digest properly, and matzah ashira is easier to digest, right? One of our kids had digestive problems for a few years, and we had matzah ashira in the house for several years on Pesach just for this one teenage kid, because regular matzah made him sick, made him ill, and gave him serious digestive problems. So matzah ashira is sometimes a solution to people who can't digest proper ordinary matzah, but it's not a solution for Seder night. For Seder night, you have to eat one kazayis, like half a machine matzah, of proper regular matzah. But there is matzah ashira. So, says the Maharal here, that when it says lechem oni, it's referring to the fact that the matzah itself is pure and simple and not enriched. That's what it means. Yeah, okay, all right, that's a good question. Yes. Many people do. In fact, I would say to you, there are many hotels, for example, who make the whole hotel kosher on Pesach. They can't possibly feed chometz to their guests on Erev Pesach. They've cleaned the place out. So they serve matzah ashira. Quite right. So eat matzah shir on Erev Pesach as a solution to that. But on Pesach itself, the minag in Ashkenaz. So if you look at the matzah ashir or egg matzahs on the shelf in your supermarket, right? You go to Rami Levi or Osher Adol, you see matzah ashir there. It says in big letters kosher la Pesach, and underneath it in tiny letters it says not for Ashkenazim. Right, so this is part of the complication of shopping Erev Pesach. For Pesach, you need to know, you have to look at the small print. Yes.
Isn't there a time limit for the Masashir Erev Pesach?
We won't go into that for the moment.
Yeah,
that's a whole other story. One doesn't eat much. One shouldn't eat too much in the afternoon of Erev Pesach. And the idea is to preserve your appetite for the evening. That's something else completely, that you should be eating the matzah b'tei avon. You shouldn't come to Seder night already full. You should have your appetite. That's a separate issue, but thank you. Yes, you're absolutely right. Anyway, so what he's saying here is, alechem oni means that the matzah itself is pure and simple and not enriched and with additives. Why is that important? Why is that significant? So have a look here. I'm still on this page number 2. Can you see here? V'zeh ki ho'oni she'ein lo elo atzmo. So here he's going into a rather conceptual analysis of the state of being of somebody who is penniless. A penniless person is somebody who has nothing in life other than himself. He's forced really to live with himself without any additives, without property, without luxuries, without belongings, without anything. Now, it's true that this is, and he's going to say this shortly, of course, that is a misfortune for somebody to live like that. It's not something not to be recommended to live a life of poverty. And the Torah isn't recommending poverty, right? There are some monasteries that expect the monks to take an oath of poverty before they enter the monastery. But Judaism does not advocate a monastic life, a life of poverty. We use wealth and we use it properly. But, he says, on Seder night is a moment when we divest ourselves of all our wealth and all our properties. And this is a moment of, so he says here, Ein lo ela atzmo ve'ein lo momon, Rak atzmo v'gufa, brings a person back to him or herself, right? Without the ego and without the wealth and without the power, just the pure individual by themselves. V'amatzah gam ken kasha ein bo rak etzem o isa. It only has the purest dough. Sha'atzmo so isu amayim v'akamach, just the water and the flour. V'zeu atzmo so isu for Havi Lechem, I've just given a little bit of it's not really a translation, a bit of a synopsis at the bottom of page 2. The matzah is the bread of poverty, not because it was eaten in the poverty of slavery, rather it refers to the matzah itself, which is deprived of all enrichment, and is the ultimate food of simplicity with no additives. What he wants to say here is, by eating the matzah, and I want you to listen to this concept, it's a very sophisticated concept. He's saying, by eating the matzah and understanding the symbolism of the matzah, the Jewish people were preparing themselves for the moment of redemption. Because in order to be redeemed, they had to divest themselves of all their connections to Egypt, all their connections to the culture, to the property, to their friends in Egypt, to everything they had done before. And it was a completely new start. They had to go to a completely new beginning. You can't begin something new so long as you have a lot of baggage from before. So the oni concept is not so much. Now the truth is, the Jewish people left Egypt with gold and silver. They weren't actually poor. Are you following me? They yotzu b'rechush gadol, the pasuk says. They came out with wealth, right? But personally, spiritually, Seder night had to be a moment of purity and simplicity and divestment of all personal, right? They sometimes speak about in the modern world, people who I don't know, when we pack to travel, I'm sure you've all had this experience, you pack to travel and you get one suitcase and it's two suitcases and three suitcases and four suitcases, and then in addition to the suitcase, you've got your hand luggage, and then even the hand luggage is not enough, you've got pekalach of all sorts of different sizes, and then you go to the airport and you see some of these students backpacking their way through the world. And you think to yourself, oh, I'd love to travel light, you know. Traveling light, halavai, I'd be able...
One T-shirt.
Yeah, they've got one T-shirt and a toothbrush and a pair of socks and sandals and they're off, right? So what is the... you know, traveling light enables a person... I'm bringing this example in our world of the association between, if you like, poverty and freedom. The person who travels light is very free. He can just travel wherever he goes. Now, the truth is, we don't associate poverty with freedom, because if you're poor, you're suffering, right? Your life is in danger and you're suffering and you can't do what you want to do. And you can't travel either, right? So really, poverty and freedom. So he says, let's move on to page 3 for a second. Look, I've just given you an introduction to the text. Have a look at the top of page 3. He says, Ve'ula yikshelecha. Maybe you'll ask me the following question. And that question is, Ma inyan ha'aniyus eitzel acheirus? Why do I associate poverty with freedom? V'halo shnei afochim hein. In actual fact, in the real world in which we live, they are opposites. If you're free, then if you're free is usually because you've got resources which enable you to travel and to be free and to do what you want. We associate being free with being able to do what you want, right, in life. And in actual fact, poverty means you can't ever do what you want. You have to just fight for survival, right? So freedom in the real world, right, is the opposite of freedom. But conceptually, he says, the moment of redemption, the moment of freedom has to be a moment when you have disconnected yourself from everything. And it's just the pure self and the pure, if you like, the pure connection. What he wants to go on to say, it is our pure connection to our HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the only thing that's left. All that's left to us is our emunah and our connection to God. And then we can get on the train of Geula. In order to get on that train, we need to be able to have gone through a moment of anius, a moment of purity and simplicity without much baggage. And that's what he wants to explain here. Hello, dol vaze ein kashe. So let me explain this to you. Ki anius ba'atzma horo la geulo. Poverty itself, conceptually, is connected to redemption. She'ein inyan ha'geulo rak she'yotze. Because the redemption requires a person to leave behind completely all his previous life. Ve'ein no shum tziruf el zuloso. The word tziruf here is important. And he has nothing connecting him anymore to his past. He has to be able to move ahead and draw a line. Everything that's happened before is history, right? We remember the history, but we're not anymore dependent on it. I'm not dependent on any properties, any friendships, any connections, any wealth. I'm not dependent on it. I'm completely free of it. Lo kama ho'evech eino omid ba'atma. A slave is somebody who is completely dependent. Completely dependent and completely commanded in other words, a slave can't enter into geula. What he wants to say is the Jewish people couldn't go from slavery into redemption without first having a moment of anyut, a moment of pure a disconnection from everything that went before, and then they could enter into the world of the geula, the world of redemption, the spiritual world. Don't forget, they were entering into the world of God's, into God's hands. That's the story on Seder night. Pressing the restart button. Thank you very much. Nothing like a computer analogy, right? You can press the restart button. That means that everything that's happened beforehand is irrelevant. We're now starting again, right? Pressing the restart button. If you had to write a commentary on the Maral from the 21st century, that is the commentary you'd put in here. And that, in a sense, is aniyut. He says, not in practice. In practice, they had wealth. But in their heart and in their mind, they were free to go. They had left everything else behind. So he says here, lo kimorot v'yeshetir who are kachad dovas yesh po ashirus. So in a funny sort of way, a wealthy man is weighted down by his wealth. So in a sense, his wealth and his properties and his connections and his obligations and his partners and the people he's involved in are all a, right? What does the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos says? Marbe nechosim, marbe da'aga. Somebody who has many belongings, it can increase his anxiety. His anxiety, it'll be taken from him. It's anxiety that he'll lose it. His anxiety that maybe doesn't belong to him, belongs to somebody else. All sorts of anxieties. Somebody who doesn't have belongings doesn't have that problem, right? So in a sense, Anius here symbolizes, that's what I've written here, halfway down page 3, poverty and redemption appear to be contradictory. Can you see that? But in essence, there is a freedom in poverty, that a person has lost all ties with belongings and wealth and remains only with the bare essentials of his own self. So really, lechem oni means the food of bare essentials. And a Pesach should be, in a certain sense, a yontif of coming back to the bare essentials of life and leaving behind the chometz. The idea of chometz is the wealth. The chometz is the connection to the physical world, which we want to get away from on Pesach.
Yes, you don't
recommend Dubai, right? Yes, I don't. Okay, now the truth is we live in a strange world in that sense. We live in a world where Pesach has become so sophisticated and food production has been so sophisticated that you get, in reality, on Pesach, you should be eating matzahs and drinking water, and some wine, and have a bit of fish and meat, and a few potatoes, v'zehuzeh. And there are people who live like that on Pesach. There are people who won't go for any processed goods, and won't even have cheese. What do you say?
Chabad.
Some Chabad people do that, some other Hasidim do that. They go back to back to basics. The whole concept of going back to basics, for a week, you can live on basics. Without all the different cheeses and all the different spreads and all the different gravies and all the different sauces and all the different types of food. You know what? You can live just with essentials. Why do they do that? Because in a certain sense, that is the lechem oni of Pesach. That is really the core idea of Pesach, to be able to go back to basics. Yes. Gedolei HaTorah lived their whole life, really. Really, back to basics. Yes, Gedolei HaTorah, even if they had access to wealth, had they wanted it, they could have had enormous wealth, but they decided to live a simple life, not to engage in the gashmiut of life. And I remember my Rebbe, Zichron Levracha, Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Erbach, who I had the zechus to learn from for many, many years. So he had a room where he learned Torah. Right, he had this apartment, a small tumble-down apartment in Shari Chesed, and about 20 yards away from there, he had, I think it was some sort of a converted garage or machsan or something, which was this room which was like floor-to-ceiling sfarim. In the middle, they had a wooden table with a couple of wooden chairs and a bulb hanging from a string, and that was it. That's where he sat and learnt. And all his writings and learnings and everything, that's where he sat for hours a day. That was his life. He sat a simple life in a simple place and didn't want anything to do with anything more sophisticated or any power or wealth or anything like that at all. He also, incidentally, didn't get involved at all in any politics or any political party, and he never appeared on any platforms or any announcements of any politics. I mean, he lived a spiritual life. It's rare to find people who do that, but that's how he lived, and because of that, he was an extremely influential and wonderful mentor for many tens of thousands of people. And I had the zechus to get to know him and spend some time with him. And when you think about the anius, that in a sense disconnecting from the material world. So he goes to great pains, the Maharal, to say, I'm not advocating that you disconnect from the material world. You can be a wealthy person and use your wealth wisely, and you can use it as a tool for lots of mitzvot and a lot of chesed, and you can do lots of great things with your wealth. It's not a virtue to be poor. It's not a virtue to be poor. But you have to be able to be poor. Be able to be poor means you're not dependent on all your wealth. You're not dependent on a luxurious life. You're able to step back from it for a moment and eat matzah. Eating matzah is a moment of stepping back from a sophisticated life and going back to basics just for a moment, in order to remind ourselves that we're not dependent, that we're using the material world. It's not using us, right? We're not codependent on it. We are using the, and that's what he says, the idea of Avraham Avinu rochev ala chamor. That's something the Maharal comes back to in a few places. To be rochev ala chamor means he's riding the donkey. The chamor means the chumriyut, the material world. He's using the material world wisely and correctly, according to his principles. He's not dependent on it. If he loses it, he'll still be the same person. Okay, yes, that's true. The sukkah is also dirat arai, you go out of your house. But it's interesting, there's also a contrast with the sukkah, because sukkot is referred to as chag ha'asif. Chag ha'asif means you've gathered in all your harvest from the field. You've got a lot of wealth, right, on Sukkos, right? And the point of Sukkos is, despite your wealth, you're still willing to live in a hut. You can still live in a hut, and without all that sophistication. Again, the idea is to use our wealth rather than to be weighed down by our wealth. Our wealth doesn't affect us. It is something which we are able to use, and that, says the Maharal, is lechem oni. The Chazal speak about this. A couple of weeks ago, I gave you a shiur here about the connection of Megillas Esther and the story of Yosef. Right? Remember Yosef HaTzadik. But with Yosef, one of the things that is mentioned by the Gemara about Yosef is that Yosef lived a life of slavery and poverty in Egypt when he was sold into slavery, and he had nothing. And then from one second to the next, he became the wealthiest, most powerful man in the empire. Right, and it didn't change him. That's what Chazal say. The most remarkable thing about Yosef was he wasn't affected by it. He remained the same person. Sadly, I must tell you, in my life, I have known a number of people who were really nice people and generous and friendly and a pleasure to be with, and then suddenly they became very wealthy. And I'm not sure what the number is, whether it's 5 million or 10 million or 100 million. At a certain point in wealth, they lost their humanity. They lost their identity. They lost their mind. They became mad, right? And you couldn't talk to them. And they weren't friendly anymore. And they felt that they were above normal human society. They didn't mix. It was below their dignity to be connected to various different things. And it just drove them mental. Some of them even lost their Yiddishkeit. Because who needs to be, right? Sadly, right? The children of Rothschild, right? Rothschild's children, and particularly his grandchildren, became so wealthy that they didn't need the Jewish community anymore. They married into royalty, and they married into aristocracy, and they lost their Shabbos, and their Kashrus, and their Yiddishkeit. Today, the Rothschilds are not Jewish people anymore. They've married into non-Jewish. There are no Yidden left in that family because the wealth had such a toxic effect on their spiritual life. So what the lechem oni here means, says the Maharal, is that what we need to be ensure ourselves of the central ho lachmo anya, we start off by saying, this is the bread of poverty, not because we plan to be poor, but because we plan to live a life of purity and simplicity. And if we have wealth, we'll use it wisely. But if we don't have wealth, we'll still live a life, the same life with the same values and the same purpose and the same connection to our Kadosh Baruch. So it's a moment in our life of Geula. And that is the Geula. That was the moment of redemption. I'd just like to finally end up on page four for a minute, because he brings an interesting, the top word on page four, dimyon. Dimyon is always an interesting word in the Maharal. Dimyon means, let me bring you an interesting comparison. It's domeh, something which is comparable. What is comparable, he says, to the moment of Leil Seder? What is comparable? So he says, Kohen Gadol, the high priest, on Yom Kippur, there's one moment that he enters into the Kodesh Kodeshim. There's one moment that he enters into the Holy of Holies, right? And in order to do that, he says, look at what he says here, Kohen Gadol, Meshamesh b'chol yemei hashana b'bigdei zahav. All year round, he's wearing the garments of the Kohen Gadol, which are gold, right? And very sophisticated, made of gold. Over Yom Kippur in Bigdei Lavo. When he goes lefonai v'lifnim, into the Holy of Holies, then he's only wearing white. V'zehu b'shulu koneh madrego elyono. And that's because at that point, he has divested himself of gold and of materialism, and he's just with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, right? And that's what he says. I've translated it here for you, just very briefly. The simplicity and purity of the matzah connecting us to a moment of pure spiritual forces is similar to the pure white clothing worn by the Kohen Gadol Yom Kippur when he goes into the Kodesh Kodashim. And the Maharal says this is the origin of the minhag to wear the kittel, to wear the white kittel on Leil Seder. Because it's in fact a moment of the Kodesh Kodesh. It's the moment of the Kohen Gadol saying we are now entering into a moment of Geula. In order to create Klal Yisrael, there had to be a moment of pure Ruchnius, unadulterated by any additives or any enrichments or any materialism of any sort. There had to be that moment. Once that moment had created the Jewish people, then yes, we can use wealth and we can use it to do good things. They used the wealth to build the Mishkan. They used the wealth to enter into Eretz Yisrael. They used the wealth for good purposes. But that moment had to be a moment of purity and simplicity, and that, he says, is the Lechem Oni, and this is the idea I wanted to share with you this morning. I hope you've enjoyed it. Take it with you to your Leil Seder, and I hope it enriches your Leil Seder a little bit, but it's typical of the writings of the Maharal, and after he wrote this, many later commentaries picked it up and developed this theme in lots of different ways. That's it for today, ladies and gentlemen.